Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And welcome to Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast, where we get to have fun. We get to learn all about exciting new things and talk about topics that we don't usually discuss on Tuesdays and Thursdays when we're normally discussing theology, apologetics, and how to explain and defend the Catholic faith. On Fridays, we just get to have a little bit of fun. And you never know. Learn something new. So let's jump into that now. The topic for today's podcast is who would win in a fight? When you're sitting around with friends, maybe guys do this more than girls, I'm not sure, but you always put out there these hypothetical situations. Who would win in a fight? Who could beat up who? In fact, there was a survey done on YouGov a few years ago putting all of these different questions, who would win in a fight, like Dumbledore versus Gandalf or Abraham Lincoln versus George Washington. And I think George Washington got a narrow win in there that he could beat Abraham Lincoln, which I find surprising. I think actually Lincoln could probably take George Washington in a fist fight. The man was absurdly tall, so he's got a good reach. And I think he was used to fist fighting. At least I remember from the children's I Am Abraham Lincoln book I routinely read to my toddlers that it says that when he was a boy, he had to he threatened to beat up some other boys who were like harassing and torturing a little turtle. And then when he moved to a new town, he had to fight the Clancy Boy gang or something like that. I'm hoping it's accurate. I'm hoping the I Am Abraham Lincoln book did their thorough historical reviews. But regardless, it's fun to put these hypothetical situations in there. So today, here's what we're going to do. We're going to cover five hypothetical who would win in a fight. And I'll walk you through these. And if you disagree, agree, either one, feel free to leave your comments at trenthornpodcast.com. If you're a subscriber, you're able to leave comments there. You get access to bonus content. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And feel free, if you are a subscriber to the podcast at trenthornpodcast.com, you could ask me, Trent, who would win in a fight between X or Y, whatever you might think. And I'd love to chime in on that to the best of my ability. All right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to do two hypothetical animal matchups, one comic book, and two very, very hypothetical military matchups that involve time travel. So, hey, wouldn't be Free for All Friday if we got really free and fancy with our hypotheticals here. All right, so here's the first one. We got the first two are animals. Who would win in a fight, a gorilla or a grizzly bear? So think that through. Actually, there's a lot of people who have talked about this online and have done through. I think Joe Rogan on his podcast has brought it up, and Neil deGrasse Tyson has weighed in on that. So first, I'll say, you know, what are your thoughts? Silverback gorilla or a grizzly bear? That's just when you picture them in your mind. Now I'm going to give you a little bit of stats on the animals. So a male mature silverback gorilla comes in at about 500 pounds. It's about average height of a man, about 5'11". They've got incredible bite force, about 1,300 pounds per square inch. Even though they're herbivores, they're not carnivores, they've got really powerful jaws, and they're ridiculously strong. It's believed that a silverback gorilla has a strength of about 4,400 pounds. Like those, if you look at the gorillas at the zoo, I mean, they have got compact and tight muscles. All right, so those are our stats on the silverback gorilla. Ding, ding, ding. But in the other corner, we've got the grizzly bear. Now, grizzlies come in a wide variety. Kodiaks are similar. But for the sake of this argument, our grizzly bear is going to come in at 900 pounds, stands at a height of 10 feet on its hind legs. And I've seen this at the zoo. They have polar bears there at the San Diego Zoo. They're kind of, they don't have a lot of blubber on them. You know, they're not as imposing. Although I guess if I was right up next to them, they'd seem pretty imposing to me. But they have a statue of a polar bear there, of a fully grown one, rearing up on its hind legs. It's about 10 feet tall. And I couldn't imagine facing off against something that's 10 feet tall. I mean, that just towering over you, making you feel like a child. So our grizzly is 900 pounds, 10 feet tall, bite force similar to a gorilla's, about 1,250 PSI. Strength level is not at 4,000 pounds, doesn't have as compact muscles, but still really strong. Grizzly bear can come in at about 1,100 pounds. People have videotaped grizzlies throwing dumpsters around at campgrounds. So when you see the two of them, they're both very strong. My opinion, I'm going to put money on the grizzly. When two people are fighting, usually you're going to put money on the heavier guy unless the other person has a ridiculous set of skills to counterbalance. So, for example, there's a video online of a kickboxer going up against a sumo wrestler. So the sumo wrestler is going to be like 3 or 4 times bigger than the kickboxer. But kickboxers are so fast and they can put so much force into a strike. The kickboxer drops the sumo wrestler in like 20 seconds. So there's no contest there. But a gorilla is not like a kickboxer. Gorilla and grizzlies are going to be mauling each other, relying on their strength. And you should go with the guy that's going to be bigger. And remember, the bear also has his claws. So a gorilla is the only weapon the gorilla has is its bite. And it has a fearsome bite. Gorilla's got a good bite. The bear has a pretty fearsome bite as well. But unlike the gorilla, the bear's got claws. So just imagine, you know, you've got, so winning gorilla versus grizzly, imagine you have a 150-pound guy who is fighting a 300-pound guy, muscle, who's got knives on his hands. Dude, the grizzly's going to win in that respect. And in fact, gorillas only have one natural predator in the wild, and that's the leopard. And leopards are way smaller than gorillas, and some leopards do kill gorillas, or the gorilla and leopard, it ends up in a draw. But if a leopard, using its claws and its teeth, is able to kill a gorilla by just getting a good bite or scratch at the gorilla's jugular, the grizzly's probably going to take the gorilla down. And according to the YouGov poll, most people, when asked, bear versus gorilla, 56% say grizzly bear, 44% say gorilla. Oh, next animal, great white shark versus killer whale. According to the YouGov poll, it's almost right down the middle. 52% think a killer whale would defeat a great white shark. 48% are going with the great white, going with Jaws on this one. According to Marine Science Today, this is how they stack up the match. So you look at killer whales. A male can reach a length of 32 feet and weigh up to 9 tons. They swim at speeds of about 3 to 4 miles per hour, leisurely, but they can do 30 miles an hour in short bursts. They have 40 to 50 large conical teeth that are about 3 inches long. They use to capture and tear prey, not to chew. And so they primarily eat fish, salmon, though they have been able to prey on other marine mammals. The great white shark can reach lengths of more than 20 feet and weigh more than 5,000 pounds. They usually swim at speeds of around 15 miles per hour. They've got those razor sharp teeth, though not as long actually as the killer whales, are 2.5 inches long to the 3 inches on the orca. According to this website, it says the great white shark might have scarier teeth, but the killer whale is bigger and faster. Killer whales also have an advantage when hunting in big groups. Sharks do not hunt usually in groups unless there's some kind of a feeding frenzy. So there's some notable examples upon the website of interactions between the two. In New Zealand, on Boxing Day 2011, a group of sharks had been swimming near the beach when a pod of orcas showed up. The orcas herded the sharks towards the shore, forcing them into shallower waters. One shark tried so hard to get away, it actually beached itself. None of the beachgoers were sure if the orcas ended up getting a good meal, but they did notice some of the sharks were injured. So I'm going to say then, if you're going to put a great white shark against an orca, a killer whale, it's the reason they call them killer whales, I'm going to go with the orca over the great white shark. All right, number 3. So we've done 2 animal ones. Now it's time for my comic book. Comic book, who would win in a fight? And of course, when you think, what is the classic comic book duo people sit and debate about? You guessed it. It is Batman versus Superman. It's actually one of the questions here on the YouGov poll. Overwhelmingly, average is about 75% of people say Superman, the Man of Steel, would win in a fight. Versus 24% who say it would be Batman. When you ask people over the age of 55, 90% of them go with Superman. Only 10% go with Batman. The highest group to think Batman could win in a fight is ages 18 to 34. So among millennials, 44% think Batman could win in a fight. 56% still say Supes would come out on top. So what is my opinion on the matter? It depends what you mean by in a fight. If you teleported Superman and Batman into a parking lot in their underwear. I guess Superman wears his underwear on the outside of his costume, but whatever. And they just in their regular clothes and they've just got their own abilities without gadgets, without any assistance or external devices. And Superman was out to kill. He was out to just kill Batman. Batman would get destroyed in about a second. Superman has got, you know, super breath. He's, you know, faster than a speeding bullet. He could just basically throw Batman into the sun. He uses laser vision and Batman would be out before he knew what would happen to him. But you also have to apply, however, the comic book rule. If Batman has enough time to prepare, he can defeat anyone. And in the comics, Batman has defeated Superman on numerous occasions. Superman has gotten the better of Batman in certain comics. They faced off over a dozen times over their respective comic book careers. But the rule is that if Batman has enough time to prepare, he knows he's going in to fight a particular metahuman, villain, whoever it may be. If he has time to prepare, he's able to come up with contingency plans to allow him to defeat any kind of opponent, no matter what. And he has done that with Superman in various occasions. One of the most famous examples is in the 1986 graphic novel, The Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller. And here, there's been a disaster that has turned Gotham City into a no man's land. And Batman is an older, gruff Batman, and he has a powered armored suit. And he's kind of come out of retirement to kind of help deal with the outlaws and all the problems that are happening. And the government has sent Superman in because they consider Batman to be an outlaw vigilante who has to be brought in. So Superman, the Boy Scout, tries to be nice to Bruce Wayne, to Batman, and says, look, I gotta bring you in. And Batman's not having any of it. So this is from the animated film adaptation of The Dark Knight Returns that I need to play with you, because I just love how they portray this grizzled bat. Once he uses his powered suit, he connects it to a lamppost to draw electricity from it. And when he shakes Superman's hand, he puts a ton of electricity into him. And then here's what the Bats has to say when he takes on Superman.
You say you answer to some sort of authority. They only want me dead because I'm an embarrassment. Because I do what they can't. What kind of authority is that?
So, you know, we have Batman and Superman facing off, and Batman is like your basic super libertarian. He has no trust of authority whatsoever. He's not going to follow anybody's orders but his own. And Superman believes in truth, justice, and the American way. So he does trust the American government, trusts the government, the authorities. He's got to come and bring Batman in. And then he puts his two cents in.
It doesn't matter. It's their world and they won't stand for you anymore. If it isn't me, it'll just be someone else.
Really? Who do they send after you?
I love that. Really? Who do they send after Superman? So Batman and Superman fight. And now here, of course, Superman is holding his punches. One of the things you have to take into account is who would win Batman versus Superman is that Superman is not dark. He's not a killer. So he has been brainwashed. There was a time in Batman Hush where he was brainwashed by Poison Ivy, who put kryptonite in her spores, the plant pods she uses to brainwash people. She brainwashed Superman to kill Batman, but Superman's still holding his punches that his inner conscience doesn't want to really kill Batman. So as they're fighting, Superman's holding his punches. Batman doesn't hold back anything. He has an older Green Arrow. So Oliver Queen, the Green Arrow, who's actually lost one of his arms by this point, is standing on a rooftop, and Batman says, "Now!" And then the old Oliver Queen fires a kryptonite arrow at Batman and it explodes and he fires it at Superman and it explodes and Superman inhales a bunch of kryptonite dust. And then we get this exchange.
It wasn't easy to make, Clark. It took years and cost a fortune. Luckily, I had both. But I didn't have to go easy on you. A different binding agent, a stronger mix. I want you to remember that. I wanted to remind you to stay out of my way. In all the years to come, in your most private moments, I want you to remember the one man who beat you.
So, pretty intense there. So yeah, who would win, Batman versus Superman? Just straight up, they're teleported into a parking lot in their underwear, and Superman is out to kill. Superman would crush Batman in a second. But if Batman has time to prepare, if he prepares and knows he's going up against Superman and Superman is just out to disable Batman, he's not out to kill and he lives by his code, then I'm going to go with Batman on that. All right, next up, we've got who would win in a fight, two hypothetical military matchups. So the first one, both of these actually are on, they're described more in detail on a YouTube channel that I enjoy listening to called Binkoff's Battlegrounds. So it's a military buff, a guy who enjoys analyzing military strategy and weapons. and often likes to pit different countries or arsenals against one another. So a lot of entertaining videos. Definitely go and check it out, Binkoff's Battlegrounds. And that's where I got the idea for two of these. I wanted to share from here and see what your thoughts are. One of them are inspired by one of my favorite movies I love to have on in the background playing on TBS if I'm not doing anything. And that is The Final Countdown. Please tell me, those of you listening, there is the song by Europe. It's The Final Countdown. So if you were in high school band, you probably played that at some football game. I'm not talking about that Final Countdown. I'm talking about The Final Countdown, according to Wikipedia, is a 1980 alternate history science fiction film about a modern aircraft carrier, I think it's the Nimitz, travels through time to the day before the 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. Directed by Don Taylor, the film contains an ensemble cast with Kirk Douglas as the leader, Martin Sheen as a supporting actor, James Ferrantino, Catherine Ross, and Charles Durning. The Final Countdown was a moderate success at the box office. So basically, the movie is about the USS Nimitz at sea. It travels through some kind of weird portal. It's not super convincing with 1980s movie special effects. And they end up going back in time, and it's December 7th, 1941, and the Japanese are about to attack Pearl Harbor. And so the Nimitz has to decide, okay, well, what are we going to do? You know, are we going to defend the United States, or are we going to stay back because we shouldn't mess with history? Here's part of the trailer for the film.
Today is December 7th, 1941. We're about to fight a battle that was lost before most of you were born. This time,
God's help, it's going to be different.
So that's part of the trailer. It's actually fun to go online and look at old trailers for movies because they're not like new trailers at all. There's not a lot of art into editing them. It's just, well, put a bunch of the clips up there and people like seeing that. My favorite old trailers are Alfred Hitchcock's old trailers. Hitchcock would just walk around, this is the house where Norman Bates lives. And he walks around and just shows you the set. And it's kind of bizarre and surreal, but it does kind of draw you into the film a little bit. All right, so what would happen? Well, if a modern aircraft carrier with all of its, especially if it had destroyers or other ships in tow, had all of its aircraft and modern armaments, it would absolutely crush the attacking force at Pearl Harbor. So this is how Binkoff summarizes it in his video on Binkoff's Battlegrounds. Especially, he starts talking about the particular weapons that are going to be on board, the fighters that are going to be sent out, and the bombers, well, fighters that are sent out to engage the Japanese fleet.
Most likely, the initial strike would be performed by the Harpoon anti-ship missiles. U.S. planes would likely get pretty close, especially the planes that observe the damage with targeting pods. But flying at over 40,000 feet, they would be completely safe from Japanese interceptors. The electronic jamming planes could also join the effort, blinding any radars the Japanese might hope to use. Basically, it would be a turkey shoot. And Harpoons might have some propellant left to burn upon explosion. There would be almost no way for the Japanese to intercept those missiles, as they're too fast and too small to spot visually until it's too late.
But then the question is, all right, so let's say this supercarrier and its crew is able to repel the attack on Pearl Harbor. Could it single-handedly stop the Japanese Navy during World War II, or could it work with the U.S. Navy to turn the tide in the war? The problem here is that in a lengthy kind of battle, you have problems that if only the supercarrier went back in time, there are other things. The supercarriers are pretty self-sufficient, but there's eventually things that they run out of that is going to be needed. So, for example, you need more fuel for the airplanes. Now, actually, jet fuel, if you had future jet fuel, you took it back in time, because modern jet fuel and the fuel that would have been used back in the 1940s are both kerosene-based, it's possible you could reverse engineer more fuel that would be needed to keep the jets in the air. That's possible. The bigger problem is coming up with things to compensate for the fact that you don't have satellite targeting. Without modern satellites and GPS, a lot of the modern weapons may not work as well in more of a long-scale war and fight against the Japanese Navy. And then there's other problems that pop up, which Binkoff notes later on in this video.
Another issue that would surely befall the US forces from the future is maintenance. Aircraft on the ships are meant to perform for several months, then receive maintenance at depots off-carrier. While various subsystems would work a few months longer than they are usually maintained for, eventually the planes would start falling out of the skies.
So yeah, planes are going to work for a while, but the problem is after 6 months, if they're not serviced, they'll go a little bit longer, but then their vital system components are going to fail, and a lot of those aren't going to be easily replaced with stuff that was built back in the 40s, especially the modern electronic equipment that's required. So that stuff will do well in a short skirmish to defend Pearl Harbor, but longer in the war, you're going to see a lot of that tech failing after, if it drags on months and months and months or years, it's going to start to become more and more deficient. And the last one that's on Binkoff's list, I'm not going to play the video from because I'm bringing in a special guest to talk about that, is this one, which I thought was really interesting, who would win in a time travel military setup. Who would win? A Marine Corps platoon of 43 soldiers against a Roman legion. A Roman legion of soldiers would be 10 cohorts of 500 men. So who would win? 43 United States Marines with modern weaponry or 5,000 ancient Roman soldiers? And to get a little weighing in on that, I'm going to share with you, I asked Chris Check, the president of Catholic Answers, who himself is a former Marine, but who also is well knowledgeable in ancient and medieval battle strategies. I wanted to get his take on this too.
All right, Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers and former Marine, military history buff. I think you'll be helpful to weigh in on our question today. The time traveling escapades, one Marine platoon versus one Roman legion. What could we look at in terms of firepower and tactics from a modern Marine platoon?
So when I was in the Marine Corps, which was some time ago, but an infantry platoon would have consisted, would have comprised three squads of about 12 men each. Each squad made up of a fire team of four. And within that fire team, you would have men carrying automatic rifles or semi-automatic and automatic. What it was, the M16A2, I assume that's the one they still use. And then there'd be a grenade launcher in each fire team, and then a light machine gun called a squad automatic weapon, which would shoot 5.56, which is the same size round as an M16. Then when deployed for combat, so a platoon makes up a third of an infantry company, but in an infantry company, you also have a weapons platoon. Mm-hmm. So and there you would find the heavier machine guns, medium machine guns like the M60, for example, which is 7.62. And so one or two of those M60 machine guns might be assigned to that platoon. And then you might even have light mortars as well assigned to that platoon, depending on how it's deployed for combat. So you could have you could even have some mortars and heavy or medium machine gun 7.62 assigned to that platoon. But a considerable amount of firepower, even with an M16, Trent, you can cover a lot of ground.
And we had spoken about this before, that a key to this would be whether our Marines are in a defensive position or not.
This is really important. So if we're talking about a Marine platoon and a Roman legion, we should say a Roman legion would be armed with short swords, maybe about 14 inches, and then spears, of course, as well, and some armor. But pretty much all they're doing is hand-to-hand. So we think about the Battle of Cannae, for example, during the Punic Wars, during the Second Punic War in the, 2nd century BC? It's in Livy. Everybody should read Livy. There you've got something like 40,000 dead in the course of a day.
Oh,
and,
my gosh.
I mean, you know, you think of the, like one of these ancient estimates of battles. On the other hand, they knew what the size of a legion was and however many legions were there.
About 5,000 soldiers.
Right, precisely. So, but a Marine's in a defensive position, and I don't even mean necessarily hardened, but like dug in and with concertina wire and claymore mines, a platoon can cover quite a frontage. And then what they're after are what they call interlocking fields of fire. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, you're at one end of this thing and I'm at the other end, and we're not shooting out perpendicular from our positions, but we're shooting across our frontage. So when the sappers are in the wire, right, so to speak, then you see that, you know, it's cool at night because all the tracer rounds are shooting. Yeah. So then you, and that's hard to get through those interlocking fields of fire when you have machine guns, M60s, or even the squad automatic weapon, or even maybe the Mod Deuce, right? The that I don't know if that's still in there, but that's the 50 cal.
Yeah.
That's been around for a very long time. I don't know if that's still in the inventory. I mean, that's an armor-piercing round, so you can tear up a person pretty good.
Yeah, even with ancient Roman armor, it's not going to be
absolutely nothing. No, they're not going to stop a 5.56 round. Absolutely not.
Right.
So,
but the key is keeping the distance, though, because if the Roman legion can overcome this distance between them...
They would make mincemeat of a platoon of 50 people. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's no hope.
So that's the key there. And of course, we're looking at this real life. One, they would be... If it was just sprung on them, the Romans would be scared of this futuristic godlike powerful weapons, even if they were familiar with it. In winning a battle, you don't have to completely destroy the enemy force to rout or force them into a panicked retreat. It's something like, what, 10, 15%?
Yeah, or 20, something like that, to really strike fear, and then people just run. And once they're on the run, then they're easy to rout. I think it's an interesting comparison, Trent, also because the United States Marine Corps and the Roman Army have a similar kind of esprit. And you see this esprit in the Roman army, especially during the Punic Wars, during the war with Hannibal, the Second Punic War, because Hannibal for 10 years is running up and down the Italian peninsula and just making a complete mess. And Roman mothers would threaten their children with, you know, Hannibal ad portas. They would say Hannibal is at the gate, you know, if their children would misbehave. Right. And so one battle after another, from the top of the Italian peninsula all the way down to Cannae, the Romans lose. Do they ever give up? Never. They never stop this fight. And then, of course, finally under Scipio Africanus, Hannibal is defeated. But so the Romans, like the Marines, they both just they're fighting. You know, they have a tenacity about them. Be an interesting fight.
Yeah,
so I hope we never have to see it.
I mean,
there is that movie where an aircraft carrier went back in time.
Yes, and I actually just previously spoke about that here on this episode. You'll have to listen to get my thoughts.
Nimitz goes back in time to Midway or something?
To stop Pearl Harbor.
Oh, to Pearl Harbor.
And then could it take on the rest of the Navy? So I'll have to send you a copy of the episode now. Yeah. But I'm very glad you stopped by for your first debut appearance here on the Council of Trent podcast.
Honestly, you've been doing this podcast for a year and a half, and I'm called in to talk about this matter here.
Well, if it's your areas of expertise, former Marine, military history buff, next time we'll
have
you on for more of a Catholic episode. But thanks all for stopping by, and thank you all for listening. Be sure to go to trenthornpodcast.com for more bonus content, and I hope that you all have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trenthornpodcast.com.